The road into the athlete's village is dusty and the traffic is awful. When you get to the site of the games, there's no place to buy food. Neither are there any restrooms. And there are no women. Hey, what kind of Olympics is this anyway? Joining me now from the BBC's Western House in London to answer that question is Neil Faulkner. He's the author of A Visitor's Guide to the Ancient Olympics. Professor Faulkner, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill.
These Olympic Games that you're describing in your guidebook, where and when are they taking place?
Well, I've set the guidebook in 388 BC. I've chosen that particular date because that was in the heyday of classical Greek civilization and therefore in the heyday of the ancient Olympics, though they did in fact run from possibly as early as 776 BC, right the way through to the end of the 4th century AD.
Several of the competitions at the ancient games would be recognizable to contemporary sports fans, but that's not true of the Pancration. Tell us about that event.
Pancration was effectively all-in, no-holds-barred wrestling. The things that you were not allowed to do in Pancration was to bite bits off your opponent or to try and gouge his eyes out. And we know that pancratiasts would sometimes crush the ribs of an opponent. We know that they would sometimes break fingers and toes. We know that limbs would be pulled out of their sockets and twisted. And the idea of Pancration really was to inflict the maximum imaginable pain on your opponent that you could in order to force him to submit.
Besides the Pancration, there were other athletic competitions, running, discus, chariot racing, that sort of thing. There was also culture of all sorts at the games, right?
Yes, there was. Because this was the top sporting and religious event in Greece, large numbers of cultural figures would go and form a kind of cultural fringe. We know, for example, that Herodotus, sometimes called the father of history, went to Olympia in order to give readings from his latest compositions, the latest chapters of his history books. We know that Plato went to the Olympic Games and engaged in learned discussion with the people that he met there.
In the contemporary Olympics, we're presented with medal counts, of course. How many medals has each nation won? Were the Greek city-states competitive in that way, or was it mostly just athlete against athlete?
No, it was absolutely as it is today in that respect. The fans in the stadium and in the hippodrome were cheering on the man from their own city-state. The city-states themselves invested in sporting facilities to train athletes, so there were gymnasia in all of the major cities. We know that there were professional trainers, sometimes paid for by the city-states. So there's no question at all that that kind of interstate rivalry was as much a feature of the ancient Olympics as the modern.
Tell us a little more about the role of the gods in the ancient games, because it's clear from your book that they were prominently featured.
Yes. In the 5 days that the festival lasted, only 2 days, we think, were given over to athletic contests, and the other days were days of festival, particularly the third day, when there was a major procession through the sanctuary, involving 100 garlanded oxen who were then slaughtered at the base of the great ash altar to Zeus. The carcasses were butchered, the bone and the gristle and the offal was passed up to the priests to turn it into a burnt offering at the top of the altar, and the meat was then taken by the sanctuary cooks to turn into a feast for all of the participants.
At the contemporary games, athletes who break the rules are disqualified. At the ancient games, such athletes were punished by judges wearing purple robes. What was the nature of that punishment?
There certainly was disqualification in extreme cases, and sometimes fines were imposed. But a more routine form of discipline was that both the judges and a group of their functionaries, called in Greek whip bearers, both judges and whip bearers, carried whips. They're sometimes depicted on vase paintings, ancient Greek vase paintings, brandishing their whips. And using those whips to impose sometimes informal chastisement of athletes who are breaking the rules during a contest. But we know that in addition to that, sometimes formal floggings were also ordered by the judges when there was a serious breach of the rules.
These days, at least, some of the athletes who win medals can anticipate endorsement contracts and celebrity status. They get their picture on the Wheaties box and so on. How were winners in the ancient games rewarded?
Typically, a successful athlete could expect prizes and privileges from his home city. He wouldn't get that at Olympia, I stress. The only reward for winning at Olympia was that you were crowned with a crown of wild olive. There were no money prizes at Olympia, but you could expect prizes and privileges at home as a reward. And what you could also expect to do is to earn a lot of money by appearing at one or other or many of the hundreds of separate local sporting festivals that took place across the Greek world.
Professor, do you think people reading your book will envy the folks who were able to attend those ancient games in Greece?
On balance, probably not. I mean, I think it's probably more fun to read about the ancient Greek Olympics and to live the experience vicariously than actually to have gone. And that really is because getting there was extremely uncomfortable, probably with a pitch on a cargo vessel or having to walk your way across Greece. Conditions in the Olympic Village were absolutely dire. Something like 100,000 people camping in the open air in the height of the Mediterranean summer in August, with minimal sanitary arrangements. So all of these things, I think, would have made the whole experience very, very uncomfortable.
But happily reading about it can be absolutely comfortable.
Absolutely right. In the comfort of the armchair or the air flight across the Atlantic, if you're actually coming.
Neil Faulkner is a research fellow at the University of Bristol, and he's the author of A Visitor's Guide to the Ancient Olympics, published by Yale University Press. And he joined me from the BBC Western House in London. Neil, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much, Bill.